despite weary joys. Tonight we are full up. In spite we rejoice like stars.
The piece is called Golden Star. It's from the album Bring Me the Workhorse by My Brightest Diamond, who is also known as Shara Nova. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted, and it is a real honor to have as my guest on the program today, Shara Nova. She's a composer, a vocalist, and producer currently residing in Detroit, Michigan, and she's released 6 albums so far under the name My Brightest Diamond. She's also composed works for The Crossing, Roomful of Teeth, Brooklyn Youth Chorus, Brooklyn Rider, Nadia Sirota, so many groups, orchestra music, chamber music, choral music, a ton of stuff. I'm a huge fan of Shara's, and it's a real honor, as I said, to have her on the program today. So let's turn to the interview. I would talk to her about both sides of her creative career as Shara Nova, but also as My Brightest Diamond, and we're going to feature a ton of her music as well.
It's tricky with me because I have really bifurcated, is that the word? I really do have like different branches of my tree. And and for me, I find that really useful and very fulfilling. But as a coming up in the age of product making or selling something, selling an identity, it is a bit confusing. Or it just takes more time to understand a complex thing, which people have little of.
So, but I feel like you've done a good job though, right? I mean, there's...
I've tried.
I mean, you've branded the two sides of your brain very differently in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But how is that as a creator? I mean, when you wake up, which do you decide which side of your brain you're going to work on any given day, or does it tell you?
The schedule tells me. Yeah,
that makes schedule. Sense.
Yeah, the schedule dictates that, and I'm at this desk most every morning, so it just depends on what projects I'm working on, and then I treat it like a job because it is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, how do you balance your own creative work with projects that are brought to you?
I've been very lucky, I think, in that most of the people that come to me with an idea, like The Crossing or Conspirare Choir, most of those collaborations are, or even like Eighth Blackbird approaching me and saying, hey, can we do a concert? It's not necessarily my internal impetus to, it wasn't something that came from inside of myself to do this particular concert, but it is something that I've certainly been informed by Eighth Blackbird, and they've informed my practice, and so it's not unnatural for me to collaborate with them. But I do think that having a connection musically is critical. And I think Nadia Sirota actually said to me many, many years ago that you are curating a trust with your listener. And so it's not just that I want to get hired to do, to sing for anyone. I'm actually curating my life, and I'm curating this trust with the audience that if I'm doing something, I felt some conviction or curiosity about it. It doesn't mean that I even like everything that maybe if I'm singing for another composer, I might not like all of it, but I don't know that it's the job of the interpreter to it's the job of the interpreter, I think, to kind of wrestle with the material than to always agree with every point of view of the composer, but it is also why I don't sing a lot of music by other composers because I don't know, it's I think it needs to be curated quite carefully.
I think that's interesting. I mean, as a composer myself, I go to a lot of concerts and I'm always thinking how not that, I'm a better composer, but how I would do the piece differently. You
Yeah.
can't help
Right,
it.
exactly. It's true.
I think that there's just that part of our brain that's always, you're like, oh, that's how you're going to end
Yeah.
it. What was your early training like when you were in music school? I mean, because I feel like people are always kind of wanting you to do one thing very well, and you do many things very well. Was there conflict there early on, or did you find your path pretty easily?
I went to the University of North Texas, and but even before that, I came from a very musical family. So within my family, there's my parents are both musicians. My dad was an accordionist and choral director. My mother played classical organ and church. She was a church pianist, beautiful singer, harmonizer, and so music was always in the family, but then even in the extended family, my grandfather was a guitar player. My uncle was a Van Cliburn competition, finalist, and so he plays Chopin, Rachmaninoff, incredibly beautifully, and also is a ragtime specialist. So I came from a family where the listening palette was extremely broad. My dad was bringing home Joan Jett records, Michael Jackson records, from the library because he thought, oh, these look cool. He didn't even know what they were. So I think that when you grow up like that, I'm just kind of living out my, the culture of my family. But my training specifically was in opera. So that was my education, is in vocal performance. And I had one semester of composition with Paul Bonneau, whose picture I keep right near my desk. Paul Bonneau spotted me and he came to clubs and was seeing me play my guitar songs. And from what I can remember, he offered to teach me composition. And so I had one, he was the only teacher that identified me as a composer in some of my last years of college. So I'm very, very grateful to him for, at that time, no women were taught in schools. And so it was kind of hard for people to fathom that, but like, no women composers were taught to me in school, and no teachers, and no one but Paul Bonneau suggested that I study composition. So the journey to becoming a quote unquote composer with a capital C was very long. I don't think it was until my 30s that I started calling myself a composer.
Thank you.
for me, naming my lineage is important, more than kind of, I guess now I've been calling myself a composer now for 20 years, so I may be less caught up in terms of that, but more so in kind of being clear with myself what is the lineage of my music and whether or not people understand what it is or can frame it. I know where my historical references are, and is and for me that's become important. I think when I was in my 20s, I wanted so much to define my own aesthetic language, as every 20-year-old wants to. You're just trying to be not the Beatles or not Mozart or whatever you're trying to not be. And so there's this very necessary period where you really have to abstract or insist on creating your own aesthetic language. And so I think it's kind of a maybe about my age that now I'm interested in relating to history because I think I have defined my aesthetic language in a lot of ways. And so I don't feel, I mean, I will always continue to do that, but I think naming your lineage is also kind of important to me right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I love that. You're so right. So much of your youth is about not being this thing, being, opposed to this, opposed to that. And at some point you go, well, I can the good news is I can take a little bit from everything, and I had a re realization when I was young too, because there was a teacher, and I can't believe she would tell me this, but she would say, you can't write in G major because, it's already been done, well, it sounds nuts now, but when you're 23, you're like, oh, okay, all right. I can't write in G major, don't write it. What about A major? No, that's been done too. Shit, and then it's like, and then at some point you go, well, wait a minute, I've never written a song in G major. So like, it doesn't matter that so many other people have, like it's me, it's me. And that is a huge and important realization, I think, for all of us. Let's talk about some of the music. I'm really happy with the sets that you brought in. I loved listening to it. I mean, so I'm good with that if you are, but I'd be happy to show off some of your choral music as well.
Cool. I've
Okay.
been enjoying writing choral music kind of in the nooks and crannies of especially I think during the pandemic, I was able to really focus on larger choral works like Titration or Infinite Movement, which I did with treble choir, SATB, double brass, and percussion. And then even before that, in 2019, with the Cincinnati Symphony, I was able to work with 10 different local choirs to kind of create this communal conversation with the orchestra that was very, very rewarding, but there's no evidence of that project except that it says I did this thing. But it was 3 hours of music. So but doing these kind of like large scale spatial projects are really fascinating for me. And then also doing things for children's choir, winter hymns, or lots of different kinds of things that I can fit in a couple weeks' time. I love being able to express through choral music in a way that I don't think I'm able to, even with my own voice.
Can you talk about Titration a little bit? I'd love to play a little bit of it.
Sure. Titration was a contemplation, like a very early contemplation of the work of Resmaa Menakem, who wrote My Grandmother's Hands. And he was looking at the way racialized bodies respond to conversation about race. And it begins in the body. Well, what is this activation? And so before even talking about race, I thought, how do I learn to pay attention to the shaking, the agitation, the nervousness, the gripping? How do I start to pay attention to the way that my body is reacting to conversations around race and say, okay, wait a second, let's slow down. What's going on here? Why am I so physically activated? And so titration is really like about the process of slowing down. How do I keep on feeling in this mean, mean world is one of the songs. And it really starts looking at grief. One of the songs is called Patterns of Protection, which was me thinking about coming from, you know, a family that the NRA is very important to family members. And so how do I look at gun violence? What is this pattern of protection that's in my DNA that I've learned? And how do I slow down enough to not be so much concerned in the outer world, but just to look at how I'm reacting?
Pa 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 p senses. Notice the subject change. Notice the shaking.
Let's talk about My Brightest Diamond. How did you start recording under that name, touring, performing, creating under that name? How did that come about?
I had a couple records before My Brightest Diamond, and one was under my name. Two were under the band name Arai, which was a collaboration with a guitar player from school, Texas, who had moved to New York with me. And then a great tragedy struck my family, and everything was different. The guitar player also decided to move back to Texas. Musically, I was going in a different direction, and so I began writing this group of songs and needed to come up with my own moniker. And did not want to use my name. I really was liking how John Zorn was having Masada or these different projects that had their own identity. And I really took from his system or formatting of his own musical life. And I thought, okay, I'm going to make a moniker so that I have this framework of this, you know, this sound. And the drummer Earl Harvin, who also went to the University of North Texas, he and I started playing together when we were I was 20. He's a bit older than me, but he was off playing with Seal and had moved to Los Angeles, and we just really musically connected. And so really, to me, though I've played with a lot of different drummers and had significant drummers in my life, the core of My Brightest Diamond is really this dialogue between Earl and I. And that kind of, you know, two points make a line. It's like having this aesthetic grounding in his playing is really very, very valuable to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when you have a, I mean, sorry, forgive me, it's a dumb question, but when you have a musical idea, do you think to yourself sometimes like, oh, this is a Sharonova, this is a My Brightest Diamond, this is a, you know, do you put it in kind of a musical place like that?
It's pretty clear. Yes. I think I've tried to stretch what kinds of topics and subject matter I could write about inside of pop music, but if things tend to be more story or sort of require other kinds of exploration, I'm thinking of a project, Infinite Movement, that I'm doing with Matthew Ritchie. There's not a personal narrative in it, like, and so I think My Brightest Diamond tends to be about my processing of my own life, and then these other more conceptual projects or you know, pieces like The Crossing Titration is not just specific to me, it's an exploration of an idea about what does the idea of how do we look at trauma in the body, and how do we process through that, whether in whatever capacity, and how do we build a communal language together. That is an idea I can explore more with a choral piece than in the context of a rock club with My Brightest Diamond. It's a little trickier. It's possible. I think in the beginning I was trying to really push what I thought pop music could be, and over time, I'm getting a little more just like, well, there's this interaction of a person on stage with an audience, and you're not going to change the sound system. You still have two speakers that are hitting people in this kind of way. And there's this dynamic that's kind of built into the cake. You can push on that, but I don't know. Yeah, I do see myself sort of accepting the dynamic and then figuring out how do I want to play with that rather than trying to just completely change the system.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think that's, there's so many people that, you know, want to reinvent this, reinvent that. And it's like, well, first of all, I think it happens organically. You know, I mean, I don't know that it happens because you set out to do something differently. And secondly, like, yeah, like you said, the sound system is set up a certain way because it works. You know, like, this is what works. I mean, why, we don't need to reinvent the wheel, you know?
I mean, I have been able to do projects in 7.2 surround, which has been super, super fun, but those exist in a museum in a controlled space and not somewhere where you got to show up and plug and play in 30 minutes. So
exactly.
It's just like, well, I got to accept that I don't have that kind of control in
exactly.
Rock and roll, and that's all right.
Can you talk about Be Brave?
Be Brave was written actually after Goretzky passed away. And I was just thinking about his life and about the Sorrowful Songs, Symphony Number 4. And thinking about all the terrible things that humans do to the planet and to each other. And that was my response and my homage to him. Be brave,
yeah.
Dear one, be changed or be undone.
broken feeling, anger swell. And so I don my beaded dress and finger bells. Shushushushara, now get to work. Shushushushushara, this is going to hurt. Be brave, dear one. Be a change.
What about We Added It Up? Can you talk about that?
We Added It Up was written in response to President Obama talking about disagreeing. And he said, we need to learn to disagree without being disagreeable. And so I was thinking about, I mean, it's kind of a Tom and Jerry sort of song. And it's very playful, but I was thinking about the very nature of cells themselves being negative and positive, that everything that holds us together is based in opposition, and trying to kind of reckon with conflict. And I was reading Brian Greene's string theory and kind of thinking, well, what if those strings that are vibrating, that's holding everything together, what if that is love itself and the love that is bigger than us? And it might be sort of idealistic or kind of naive, but I keep hoping that we can find a way through difference to stick together. And so that song is kind of this love binds the world, is really me trying to put a little something into the world that I hope can move us toward love.
There was you, there was me. We never could agree if I was up. Down. You were there, I was here, a grand puppeteer, stuck it all together. If I was cat, you were a dog. If I was tied up, you were a hog. If I was flat, you were a ball. If I was charged, then you were cash. If I was tots, you were the mash. If I was loud, then you
And those songs are from the album All Things Will Unwind.
Mm-hmm.
Were those, I mean, is there an underlying concept to the album? Do the songs kind of hang together and flow, or are they just songs that you had written at that time that you put together for that album?
I had just moved to Detroit and I had a baby in July, and I wrote, that was 2010, and my grandmother passed away in December of that same year. So it was sort of like this mass education in class, because moving to Detroit, I came with these narratives of, oh, it's the new frontier, which is so white and so settler mentality. But that was a language that I had, you know, was coming with, oh, it's the blank canvas. Well, nothing is blank, you know, it's so disrespectful. So there's songs about class, there's me learning Detroit history and kind of getting smacked in the face with my own ignorance, and also this movement from the I to the we. Having a child for me was this, the pronoun I really shifted into the collective. So I was really starting that shift and to say, hey, it's not just about me anymore and my own identity, but what am I a part of? So that was a really big transition.
Can you talk about your latest album too, Fight the Real Terror?
Yes, I hadn't been able to see my drummer in all of these years because he lives in Berlin. And though we could write things separately, just the viability of me being able to tour with a drummer after COVID, you know, I really needed to be able to just simply play on my own. And I'd been asked to open for Wilco, and Andrew Bird had me open for him. And I couldn't play my own songs because I didn't write them to be played solo. They're not constructed in that way to really survive my limited guitar playing. So, or piano playing for that matter. So I needed to compose, you know, write songs that I felt good about playing on my own. And I had a month set aside to write a song. And then was going into the recording studio to work with Tom Schick in Chicago, who runs Wilco's recording space, The Loft. And I the first week, nothing was coming. I couldn't get the first notes. And then on July 26th, Sinead O'Connor passed away. And I was very deeply affected by her, and so began contemplating her life and wrote the first song, Fight the Real Terror, in response to her charge to all of us to fight the real enemy, and just sitting with, well, what does that mean? And then the songs came from that. But it was a very rushed record. I recorded all of it in less than 3 weeks, and then went to Tom and said, hey man, you ready to re-record these? And he was like, nope, we're not re-recording any of it. And that was pretty terrifying, to use the word lightly.
On the day she died, a storm came in. It cut down the trees with a force. The lights went on. Seemed about right for the whole world to stop for Sinead. Fight the real terror. Fight the such a catalytic act than to respect a living and furious woman.
Real quick, so tell me about the concert with 8th Blackbird, the date, everything. Let's tell our listeners about that and anything else you have coming up as well.
Yeah. So on February 13th in Chicago, Imaginary Lovers, which is a collaborative premiere with 8th Blackbird and myself, will be performing together at 7:30 at the Athenaeum Theater. And it's all different kinds of songs about love, all kinds of love. And so I hope folks can come see this never before presented collaboration with Eighth Blackbird.
Anything else coming up that you want to talk about?
I'll be touring for 2 weeks in Europe, and then in April I have a choral premiere with Mount Holyoke, and I'll be premiering wind ensemble arrangements of My Brightest Diamond with some new songs at Missouri State University in April. So I'm excited about both of those shows. So lots of things coming up in the spring to keep me busy with Sibelius.
You're lucky. I'm a Finale user, so I have to now learn the new software.
Oh, man.
I know. That was a real bummer and not announced very well. But anyway, they just left us all out to dry, you know. Sherry, it was such a pleasure to meet you and talk with you. And thank you for the wonderful music. And I just appreciate your generosity, giving me so much time to chat about your music and everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much for listening and for your support, Seth.
Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. Thanks so much to Sharon Nova for being on the program today. Find her on Spotify, check out her concert dates, all the great things that she does. And for Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.